Hello and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. My guest for today is Lori Lee Elliott, co-founder and CEO of Dauntless XR, a software company that's providing extended reality solutions for aviation, aerospace, and other industries. Lori Lee originally founded her company in 2018 to work on industrial solutions within the energy industry. Last year, she rebranded the business and pivoted to new industries, and she shares on the show today how she navigated this process and her tips for working on government contracts. Lori Lee, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really excited to catch up because it's been a few years, and you know, you might not be too unfamiliar to the Innovation Map community because we have spoken before, but for those who don't know you, I was wondering if you could share a little bit about your path to entrepreneurship. Were you always interested in being a startup founder?
I've always been interested in business and technology and innovation in general, but startup founder was never on my, you know, list of careers to try. So I went to grad school for journalism and did a bit of entrepreneurship crossover there. And then I ended up in the energy sector, in the oil and gas industry, in the LNG market, doing a type of field engineering, where I was on site doing a lot of database management. And that's actually kind of where my entrepreneurial journey started. So we were on these, you know, executing these mega projects, you know, the world's leading technology, lots and lots of dollars behind it. And I was really shocked when I got there that the technology we were using to actually do our work day to day was not that advanced. There was a lot of pen and paper systems still being used. I had a literal shipping container that they provided me to keep all of my inspection records and all of the documentation we would need for handover. And I just kept thinking, I was like, you know, there has to be a better way of doing this. And, you know, being young and a little bit naive, I was like, I'm going to create it. It doesn't seem to exist out there, so I'm going to go and make it. And it was a multi-year journey getting there. Like I said, startup founder was never on my bingo card. So in the beginning, I've reached out to lots of other development companies, dev shops, people in the XR space to try to get this concept I had built. And it took a really long time before a VC mentor like sat me down and was like, you just need to build this yourself. Like, stop wasting time, get it together, and go build it yourself. That's the only way this is going to happen. And that's how I ended up becoming a startup co-founder.
I think it's funny that there has to be a better way mentality is like one part of the equation of being an entrepreneur, but the other one, which is probably even more important, is the like take initiative, try to figure out how to build it, because I think those two go hand in hand. But yeah, definitely need that follow through to really kind of enter the entrepreneurship world. So yeah, so that obviously, you know, led to you starting FutureSight AR, which was focused on augmented reality tech for construction within the energy industry. And you started that company in 2018. So what all has happened now? I know a lot has happened since then.
Yes. So we knew so little about what was coming in 2018, but we originally started the company to do augmented reality guided workflows for industrial workers and, you know, executing these projects like the ones I was on. And we knew at the beginning that that was not the only vertical that could benefit from XR guided workflows. You know, pretty much anyone that does a step-by-step task that has any level of QA, QC, or expertise involved would be able to use it. But that was on our roadmap for like 5 to 10 years down the line, we'll figure out another vertical. And then during the pandemic, the industry, like all industries, got kind of shaken up, and we had to figure out like, how are we going to do this thing with the new work landscape? And we started trying a bunch of different things. I ended up speaking at an event for the Air Force, where they reach out to entrepreneurs and startups and get them to come in and talk about, you know, how the different technologies that they're working on works, and just, you know, do some general education stuff. And That was really eye-opening. So we talked a little bit about what we did, and then someone from the Air Force side actually came to us and was like, "Hey, I know you're doing this for, oil and gas and construction, but do you think we could use this within the Air Force or use it on base?" And we kind of, looked at each other, we're not sure, but we'll find out. So that's when we started doing research and development with the Air Force. They got us on contract, and we did a couple feasibility studies, which we then rolled over into contracts to develop MVPs, and it's just kind of been going from there. And it's been really interesting to see the traction and development within the Air Force and then the DoD larger, and now with NASA. It's been quite a change just over the last 3 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to talk a little bit more about, working with the government and that process. But I want to talk about your rebrand because that and kind of a pivot. I don't know if you use that terminology, but into what the company is now called today, Dauntless XR. So what was it like navigating that rebrand? What was the impetus to starting it or to rebranding?
Yeah, it was a couple of factors kind of came together. The, I guess, catalyst for it was in 2022, we acquired another company and were able to combine their technology with our own. And when we came out on the other side of it, a lot of people asked us, they're like, "Well, are you going to change your name? Are you like, you absorbed this other company and their technology? Like, are you them now?" And unfortunately, I can't name them, but we kind of were like, "No, we don't really feel like that's us. That was someone else's baby, someone else's, brainchild." And at the same time, FutureSight was, we named the company that because we were alluding to a construction site, and there's a bit of a play on words, and we're like, we don't really do that anymore. So we wanted something that was a name that was a little bit more future-proof. If we wanted to dabble in other technologies, like I think in the future, there's definitely going to be a crossover between extended reality and generative AI. And if we're now using that in our company, like I want it to still make sense. So we wanted something that was a little bit more representative of this new thing that we had evolved into, and then also something that was going to stand the test of time going forward. And we actually really enjoyed the rebrand process. We got together, we did, we brainstormed all different names, different, what we wanted the company to be about, our vision statement and your mission statement, figuring those two out. We had a really good time with it. And that was fun. We kicked it off at the beginning of last year. So we've been a whole year now as our new selves.
Yeah, I think that's funny because I mean it does sound stressful, especially if you're really tied to that original name, but you also know a lot more when you're kind of rebranding. You can have the intuition to know that this has to be like a name that can carry you through the future of your company. And it's also not something super, rare, I think, for startups. I think a lot of founders have to go through that process. So I know you said you really enjoyed it, but were there any challenges or obstacles you had to overcome that you didn't necessarily see coming in that process?
There were a couple things around, the doing the name research itself, because we wanted to make sure, we're operating in all of these different industries. We didn't want to pick a name that has baggage associated with it. And when you don't, you can only do so much research before you're like, okay, we might miss something. But we thought we were pretty safe there. And then just like practically on the execution side, like moving the website and all of that stuff over was, don't get me wrong, it was a pain in the neck, but it happened. I guess the most like inconvenient thing was we had a couple of places that we were registered with, like as FutureSight AR, that now show us as out of business when we're not. We've just rebranded, and there's no way that you're going to capture all of them when you're trying to go through and make sure you're updating everyone on your contact list. So every so often I'll get like an email or something kicked back and be like, "Didn't you don't are you still operating? Like, what's going on?" I'm like, "Yes, we are. We're still here." It's just a new name. So I think that was probably it.
That does seem like something that you wouldn't think about because, yeah, you haven't gone anywhere. So, how has your technology evolved this process? I mean, when you look back over the past, I guess it's almost 6 years now, how has the technology evolved, and what is that, what sort of doors has that opened for y'all?
So our core technology, our core application, which is called Katana XR, has actually remained pretty consistent, which I think speaks to the strength of the value it provides. So that's XR guided workflows. And I think how it has changed is we've made it more and more scalable over time. When we were first starting out, and it was, very much like get this concept out of our brains and into an application, it was not that scalable because we were just trying to demonstrate, like, does this work? Is it useful? But over time, we've gotten better at making developmental decisions that are going to allow us to have this product reach more people and in more markets. And that's things like different module types. So there's not just one kind of workflow, like a checklist. There might be conditional workflows. So if you answer yes to one question, it will send you down a different route to if you answered no. That's like a really basic one, and doing these things that keep adding value that allow us to reach more and more different use cases. And that takes discipline, as we've learned. We've seen, other companies in the space that are so focused on getting their market share that they make decisions that are going to paint them into a corner. And you only do that a couple times before you get burned and you're like, okay, no, you need to make sure you're doing something that's for the long run. And then the other thing that's changed, this application, we have a second application now that didn't even exist, wasn't even an idea in our heads yet last time we spoke. And that's the one that you covered for NASA. So that's Aura. And Aura is a mixed reality data visualization platform. We primarily use it for machine-generated data, whereas Katana is more human-generated data. And the Air Force right now is using it for visualizing aircraft files. So the flight recorder data that they pull off the various aircraft, you can load it up into our system and it will give you a kind of replay of the mission or of the flight so that Air Force personnel can debrief a mission or debrief a training exercise using this beautiful 3D hologram of their flight rather than having to, draw it out on a whiteboard, or they use, airplanes on sticks. I don't know what the official term is for that or if they have one, but I've seen it plenty of times where they get out their collection of little airplanes on sticks. So we wanted to give them something better than that, and that's what you can use Aura for. It shows every second of the flight over a 3D topographical map. You can see your flight path. We replicate the primary flight display so you can see what all the instrumentation we're doing at every second. And what we're essentially doing with NASA is we're taking that and allowing you to layer in space weather data. So NASA has lots and lots of data available. It being space, it's naturally 3D, so that makes it a great candidate to be onboarded onto the platform.
Yeah, and from what I understand from what your work with NASA is specific to the space weather and solar activity. So how has that been navigating a whole other world outside of Earth? It's interesting. What kind of learning about that new industry?
Yeah, it's been a challenge. It's been a fun one. I mean, we're not pilots either, and we had to learn all about how missions are run and how aircraft fly and like all the instrumentation data as well. And it's always interesting. It keeps you on your toes. But yeah, I'm just gonna put out there, I'm not a space weather expert. I don't have a PhD in physics or anything like that. So it's been a challenge, but it is really fun to be able to kind of dive into these different industries and learn a little bit about them. And the space economy right now is really interesting because it's growing like crazy. And when we start getting into these proposals and getting into these contracts, there's that initial kind of discovery phase where we go out there and I get to put on kind of my journalist hat again and talk to a whole bunch of experts, talk to people that are experts and have been in studying in these fields for, 20, 30 years, and borrow their 10,000 plus hours to kind of inform what we are doing. But yeah, it's a fascinating time where we're heading towards the peak of the next solar cycle. So the sun is very active right now, and it's going to get a little bit more active, which can be a bit dangerous if we're launching equipment and people into space. So It's yeah, like I said, I keep saying it's interesting, it's fascinating, and I'm really excited to see where the industry goes and what we see come out of it in the next, 2 to 5 years.
Yeah, I think I feel the same way when I was, reading about your work with NASA. I got on a whole other tangent of looking. I was like, what is space weather? Because I know what weather, like Earth weather is, but there's not that atmosphere. So I'm like, what is space weather? And so it was really interesting. And I guess it'll be really cool to see kind of other applications for your technology. So that's kind of cool that since it is, you can specify and provide custom software almost with this platform that you've created. It seems like you're gonna keep finding these new niches to enter in, and it will be kind of like journalism where you just like get to learn different industries all the time. That's kind of what I do.
Yeah, no, exactly. That was what we kind of realized when we built out this platform. It doesn't have to be just for one thing. We can make it able to ingest all different kinds of data sources, but it does require us as the developers and the architects to go in and learn a little bit about each one. And that's great because I get bored easily. So it's an endless source of fascination.
Well, let's talk about the business side of working with government entities, specifically for you, NASA and the US Air Force. I know you mentioned that these kind of opportunities came about and you kind of had to learn on your feet on how to navigate these relationships. So, what are some of the lessons you learned through that process that I'm sure some Houston founders are eager to hear about?
Yeah. So the program that we use to first do these contracts is the SBIR STTR program. It's sometimes called America's Seed Fund. And that's where we got our first phase one contracts. And those are just feasibility studies, but they call them phase ones. And the lessons learned going into this, I would say, is if you are interested in pursuing them, is go and get all of your government registrations and certifications before you start. They have fairly quick close deadlines. So when an opportunity opens to when it closes is usually a month. And that is not enough time to go get your company registered with all the different places it needs to be registered. You need different codes, you need different logins. At one point, I had like a checklist, like a PDF checklist that I would send out to other founders that were starting this, because I'm like, there's so many that you need to keep track of. And then each agency has slightly different ones. So we didn't know with NASA, once you got awarded, you need a special NASA login. And the only way to get that is once you're already on contract. And since it was our first one, we had to wait. And we have, deliverables that we're just getting later and later for, and we're like, we can't get in. We're sorry. Our background checks haven't come back yet. We don't know what to do. So that's the first thing I would say. It's just before you even look at the opportunities out there, and start getting FOMO because you can't bid on them, go get all your registrations.
That's a good tip. I mean, because as you said, it's a quick process to submit. That window's only open for so long. So yeah, getting all of those, it seems like a lot of red tape, but that is to be expected. What other lessons learned did you have? What are some of the things that I know you speak to this now about the process? What are some other things that people ask you about?
I guess within the process, like once you have your registrations and you're going in and looking at these opportunities, I get a lot of questions about the actual proposal itself, like how to put together a proposal that really clearly communicates what your offering is, but then also why it is innovative and kind of worthy of this funding that is supposed to be reserved for like the very cutting edge science. And that can be really tough to communicate when you're given, like, you got to do this in 10 pages or less, succinctly. So I get a lot of questions around that. And then kind of the difference between SBIR and STTR. We've done both. We have both ongoing at the moment, but an SBIR is something that can be completed just by the small business. You are allowed to use subcontractors and consultants as necessary, but it's primarily done by the small business. And then an STTR is something that you partner with a research institute for. And the research institute has to complete at least 30% of the work. And because of the nature of those proposals, there usually is, that kind of academic side to it. You're conducting something that's probably heavier on the research side than the development side. You might be, in some cases, it's reserved for if you're doing like human subject testing or something with DNA or things like that, where you do need a certified research institution to handle that part of the work. But like I said, we've done both, and figuring out like which one is going to work for your business is a very case by case basis. But that's the big thing when you first get into this, is like, what on earth do each of these mean?
And I know you mentioned to me before we started recording that the irony of this all is you're navigating these government relationships as a Canadian yourself. So what's that been like? I guess I feel like you've earned a citizenship with all of this work that you've done.
Yes. No, the only way I'm able to do this now is because I do have my permanent residency, so that helps a lot. As far as the government's concerned, I'm a resident now. But yes, it is a little bit ironic that I came in as a Canadian and had to figure out how to do all of this.
So now that you've rebranded the company, you've got these really great contracts, what do you see for the future for your business? Does this include raising additional funding, growing your team? What's on that radar for you this year and maybe in the next few years?
Yeah, I think in the next year we're going to focus on kind of building out our contract pipeline and getting the applications to a spot where we're really comfortable with a commercial offering. I would say, and this is probably a little controversial, I don't think the XR market right now is a good candidate for venture capital. So people raise venture capital for all sorts of different reasons. But for me, like, my thesis behind it is you need that cash injection so that you can build a product faster than everybody else and take a bigger market share than your competitors so that you can dominate in the market, you can succeed, and you can get your investors a return that's, 10x that they want on their investment. Would you say that's like a fair assessment of, venture capital, right? And back in like 2016, everyone thought that the XR market was at that point where you needed that to compete. It's like what AI is now. If we look at what AI was a year ago, like, it was like, meh, okay, yeah, people were raising rounds and getting investment. But now, unless you have serious venture capital behind you, you're not going to be able to compete in the market because it's so hot. I don't think XR is at that place right now. The Apple Vision Pro coming out, things that might change, but I don't think it's a good candidate for VC funding, because you're not going to see that explosive growth that you need to get those returns back to your investors and their LPs. So we'll check back in a year. If we were ever at that point, like, yes, we would definitely consider raising a round so that we can pour some jet fuel on our development fire. But right now, I think the pace that we're going with being profitable and the contracts we have is sufficient.
I think that's really smart, and that shows that you're very tapped into what's happening to make that decision, and also totally fair. I think it seems like the VC market, which has had its challenges the past 18 months, and now it does seem like all of the activity is centered around AI, and whether that's just everyone coming up with new companies that are utilizing AR, or what I think more realistically is happening is companies are shouting from the rooftops about their AI, and like it's like a branding play or like kind of marketing play. Like so many companies are based off of data, which can say AI. You can now put AI on your tagline of your company, right?
Yeah, it was like that with Web3. Like, 2 years ago, everyone was adding, like, what was the extension? Not .io, but like, it was .io to the end of their company name. Now it's .ai, and it's going to be something else in another 6 or 12 months. So, yeah.
Who knows what it will be. But that's really interesting. I love that take. And I think even though I think you said it was a little controversial, but I love that. I think a lot of people probably agree with you on that kind of assessment. One other thing I love to talk to you about, because I think you went from your original concept and working in a very Houston industry, right? And now you've kind of pivoted a little bit with your work with NASA specifically into another legacy Houston industry. So how do you see Houston's role in your career and your company and the impact it's made?
I think Houston is great because you can get exposed to so many different industries while you're here. Like there's also the giant like medical and medical technology industry is here as well. And that's all just within this tiny radius. And I think Houston has played a role in that it's been a really great place to grow the company. You have low cost of living, but high quality of living. So it's different to being in the Valley or in New York, where you're gonna, suffer a little bit and live in a shoebox apartment and spend all of your money just on cost of living. Whereas here, you can have, you can still enjoy great quality of living while building a company, which is, I think, a little bit uncommon. And being kind of a hub, like it's easy to get everywhere. If we ever need to travel for anything, there's, like I said, it's easy to do. And even aviation, like having, because we're in the aerospace industry as well, having United here, that brings in that market as well. So all of these resources are pretty widely available. And I think yeah, it's been a great place to get a start and grow.
Yeah, do you feel like you have feel like you made the most of the resources available, but is there any like thing you find lacking in Houston or like seems room for improvement just from your own personal experience with your company?
Yeah, I mean, there's always things, right? Like, doesn't matter where you go. I think in Houston, what it lacks is a little bit on like the startup culture side. And this was not something I heard this at an ION event. So unfortunately, I don't remember who I heard it from, like who was speaking. But if it's you, please let me know, and I will credit you with this. But on the startup culture side, in places like in San Francisco, LA, New York, it's not that uncommon to know someone who either founded a startup or worked at a startup and owned equity. And when those companies have exit events, you get paid out, right? Like founders have, sort of different setups, but it's not that uncommon to know someone who has benefited from working at a startup and maybe not made like life-changing money, but made like year-changing money, or, given them a little bit more financial freedom to do whatever it is they want to do or make riskier moves. In Houston, it is not that common to know anyone who has equity in a startup. And not that many people have seen like the benefit to going and working at a growing company versus working at one of the like major corporation legacy companies that are here. There's not that value isn't commonly like known or talked about very much. Like it's still, people still don't really know what to say to me when we're at dinner parties and they're like, "Oh, you run your own company? Like you work for yourself? Like are you a freelancer?" Like I don't understand. I'm like, "No, I have a tech company. We make software." Like, and they're like, "Oh, like it doesn't like quite connect." And I think that's why. I think, whoever I'm quoting but not able to give credit to was onto something. That's why it's, we don't have that here. So I think that's something that will change over time. You get more companies here, more companies that give away equity to their employees, and you start to have those stories of, like, oh yeah, we got acquired and I got this payout and it did X, Y, and Z for me, and now I'm here doing this other thing. You'll start to get more of those stories, and it will build on itself. But I think that is definitely lacking. I don't know, in your reporting experience, have you
Yeah.
encountered that?
Well, I think that's, I love this answer and this observation because from how I've always heard it described is that, to have a successful ecosystem is you have to have success stories and like those people kind of reinvesting in the ecosystem. So whether that's a startup that exits and then that founder creates a VC firm because based off of their success and then, whatever, like that's part of developing an ecosystem. But I love this specifically because you're talking about and whoever you're referencing was talking about just the like word of mouth and like fellow not even founders but people who worked at a startup and saw it exit successfully and then can kind of be an example of not only the founder success story but just an early hire success story because that's totally more prevalent on the coasts and just this like it's just funny to me how big of a difference that makes that the colloquialism and like the knowing a startup and knowing that this culture exists That is definitely something I mean, obviously not something you or I have to deal with. We very, very much know of startups in Houston, but yeah, like just the general populace doesn't necessarily know what's happening, and that there are startups and how the startup world works. So hopefully that is something that changes, because yeah, as much as it's great to have growing infrastructure and a very connected community, which I think Houston does have, you know, the success story and the word of mouth and just the people of it is definitely evolving still and growing still.
Yeah, it's definitely still growing. And I think the owning equity in, the companies that you work for or companies that you own part of, I think that's going to be a growing trend over the next few years as people get more comfortable with the idea that, working for a big corporate for your entire career might not be able to check all the boxes for you that it used to in the past. That used to be like the safest thing you can do. And that is proving to not always be true going forward. And people in general are getting more comfortable with the idea that, you might need to do a little bit more. And that doesn't mean you have to go out and, found a company. Crazy people do that. But you might be in a situation where you're going to own equity of a startup, or maybe you decide to go buy a mom and pop shop, like mom and pop main street business that you own part of, and that's going to become a little bit more normal. But yeah, but it's that's a whole other conversation. But yeah, I think it'll get there though.
Yeah, I think it just has this perception of being risky, when it's almost riskier to not have that
Yeah.
connection, ownership, and stuff. So just a mindset shift with, I guess, I want to credit it to like newer generations, but it's also just like maybe the ways of the time.
Yeah, it's odd that it's a blind spot because people are okay owning shares of a company. Like you own some S&P 500, no one's really gonna fault you. No one's gonna be like, oh my God, that's so risky. I mean, it is, but people are okay with it. People are okay with owning property, which is a different kind of equity. That's also not, no one's gonna give you too much grief over that. But when you start venturing into this is a startup or even if this is a main street business, then people are a little bit more like, I don't know about that. So it's weird. Like you said, just culturally, at a cultural level, like why? But I think it'll change.
Awesome. Well, you've given like just me personally a lot to look out for and think about. So I appreciate that. And it was wonderful catching up with you and learning about kind of this evolution of your company and your career. And like I said, it's such a great Houston story. So appreciate you sharing it on Houston Innovators Podcast.
Thanks for having me. It was great to catch up and see you again.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.